Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. All right, Molly, you ready?
Uh-huh.
All right, let's go. Let's go.
By ready, I mean taking a large sip of coffee, but basically ready.
Hey everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us, as we like to say around here, is as smart as all of us.
That's right. I'm Molly Wood. It is Tuesday, which means it's time to get some help being smart, dive deep into a single topic. And today you can hear the joy in my voice because we are just taking, let's just call this a personal day. Like a day we just want to talk about this thing. The issue that led to banana pants becoming a thing on this show, the company that went so far past bananas it ended up at pants, WeWork.
It's just an amazing story. So we did an episode like 2-3 years ago about WeWork's IPO that went horribly wrong. Failed is a good word you could use. Also founder Adam Neumann's Neumann, I pronounced it like the microphone, Neumann. His bootage from the company. A lot has changed since then. It was like a $47 or $50 billion company at one point. Now it's down to $9 billion. It's no longer trying to, and this is their quote, raising the world's consciousness. It's actually doubling down on real estate, plans to go public via a SPAC. We've talked about those.
Mm-hmm. We have a whole episode about that, too, because it's sort of equally bananas. We will put that in the show notes. That, of course, though, is that special purpose acquisition company that a lot of companies are using these days, where one company goes public as a blank check to bring in lots of others to presumably speed up the process, but potentially get rid of some of the public-facing scrutiny that the traditional IPO route entails.
So this is a story, honestly, yes, about WeWork, but about a bunch more, about startup culture, about finance and how all that works. Also, in a way, about the economy that was and the economy yet to be. And so that's what we're going to talk about with Maureen Farrell. She is a correspondent at The Wall Street Journal, also a co-author of the new book. It's called The Cult of We. We work Adam Neumann and the Great Startup Delusion. Maureen, it's so good to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me.
I wonder maybe if the first place to start is with Adam Neumann and who he was and where he came from and where this company came from.
Sure. So Adam Neumann was originally from Israel. He moved over to the United States after serving in the Israeli Navy for many years in about 2001. And he was an entrepreneur from the minute he set foot in New York. And one of his first companies, he went to Baruch College in New York for a while, dropped out like every good entrepreneur is known to do. You drop out of college to go after your business. And Adam Neumann's case, it was a baby clothes company. And he had this brilliant, in his eyes, very brilliant idea. He realized that he didn't have children of his own. Babies crawled. He thought their knees hurt, but they couldn't tell anybody. So he built baby clothes with built-in knee pads. That was his first business.
I'm like, I just want to interject and say, I am already so delighted with how this episode is going. So delighted.
So glad. Was not the giant business he was telling everybody it was going to be. But he was in downtown Brooklyn at the time, before the financial crisis, like in the mid-2000s. And he met an architect. His name was Miguel McKelvey. And they both started sort of talking about all different business ideas they might do together. And he stumbled upon this whole idea of subdividing office space. And they started with this company called Green Desk in an area in Brooklyn and decided to try it out. Would people take a fully fledged office instead of buying their whole own office space, outfitting it? What if they just did that and subdivided the space? They convinced a landlord to let them do that in a few floors in downtown Brooklyn. And it worked incredibly well. And that essentially became the genesis of what a year or two later would become WeWork.
What was the mechanism then whereby he gets from, the thing he was doing in Brooklyn to this thing that, and look, I follow business news reasonably closely, but it did seem that he kind of, WeWork sprang fully formed upon the scene as a gargantuan of the temporary office space thing. And I wonder how he got from Brooklyn to there.
When he first started his business, I mean, it took a lot to get this first building going. But essentially, you know, how it took, he convinced a landlord yet again. He got some investments, friends and family, and they made this first building work. And it was around the time of the financial crisis. So there was tons of empty office space. So it was a little bit easier to sell this whole concept. Some other people were doing it. But in terms of the answer to your question, Kai, in terms of what changed it from this thing that other people were doing, it was a neat idea. It made sense, you know, in this post-financial crisis New York with this empty office space. A lot of people are starting as entrepreneurs. But venture capital was really the answer. By 2011, 2012, Facebook was booming. The tech sector was, you know, really already starting to take off in such a huge way. And he just started calling this company, you know, we're not an office-based company. He started saying, oh, we're the physical Facebook. We're Facebook in the third dimension. And he started pitching this company to venture capitalists as like the next fast-growing company. And what Adam Neumann was, as he was an incredible salesman, but what he was probably the most incredible at was raising money, tons and tons of money. And part of the way he did it was by convincing tech investors that this was a tech company and, you know, not a real estate company, which is still, even after writing this book and following this company, it's sort of hard to fathom how he was able to do that.
So wait, in the process of writing and researching this book, you never ran across the secret the secret deck that shows the actual technology here?
Oh, yeah, no, I never. Well, there would be like glimmers of technology, but they, you know, it was funny each step of the way he was calling it. He sort of always knew how to hook on to what venture capitalists wanted. You know, in 2012, it was the physical Facebook. Eventually, it became more of an artificial intelligence company. And we saw tons of pitch decks, and he would sort of put some of the hot button terms of what was in the sort of tech zeitgeist at the moment. He would weave them into WeWork. But it kind of made no sense. And what you never saw was how it translated into a profitable tech company. He was always billing it as, you know, it was going to take on the look like a tech company, but it never did. As you both know from covering the failed IPO, it was growing revenue and growing losses just as much until, you know, the day of its ill-fated last IPO.
So all these investors and venture capitalists, primarily among them SoftBank, the big fund, they like got fleeced is too strong a word, but they got sold on this vision by this guy?
Yes. It's incredible. I mean, each step of the way. And I mean, these are... Benchmark is considered one of the top venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, and they were one of the first big investors. And yes, each step of the way, JP Morgan, Harvard's endowment, SoftBank, Goldman Sachs, like even their wealth management arm, each and every investor he did, convince them. And the funny thing that we noticed was that he would always get to sort of the top decision maker and have them see the light of why this was not the company you thought it was, and it was so much more. And then there would be underlings who would start doing the math and go through the numbers and say, I don't know if this valuation makes sense. You might want to look at this more. And they were overruled by these top people who were just sort of immediately smitten with Adam Neumann.
I mean, I feel like that ultimately really is the key to this story, because it is hard to understand if you are a rational person or have not been in the position where you're just kind of like swayed by a charismatic cult leader and the kind of accompanying greed that goes along with it. But like, this is the Silicon Valley story. And when you look at the sort of collection of founders all around us now, Mark Zuckerberg, Travis Kalanick, right? Like any one of them could have been Adam Neumann, except for maybe some luck and like marginally better business sense.
And a business that was able to translate really into what they were saying it would. I mean, not Uber, obviously we're still looking for profits, but I mean, they had a little bit more credibility and I mean, obviously Facebook a lot in being a real tech company. I think Adam Neumann was just able to take it a few more jumps and then take many more jumps in terms of taking money out of the company to each step of the way.
Yeah, well, we should say here, as part of his separation from the company and the defenestration of WeWork in terms of the IPO and where it is now, he walked away with, I want to say billions, but certainly tens and hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yes, more than a billion. It's sort of almost up to 2 billion by the time you add in all different things into it. But when at the time of his IPO, that the IPO fell apart in 2019, SoftBank was saving the company. There's a real chance it could have gone bankrupt. And as part of saving the company, they paid Adam Neumann a more than $100 million consulting fee over 4 years. And this is as they were laying off thousands of employees. It was just at the time this was happening, someone called me who was sort of in the room as the decision was being made and said, this is what happened. These are the numbers. And people are going to be absolutely horrified that this happened. And Adam walked away with that much money.
And they were right, because people were horrified.
Yeah. Except people were... I mean, I guess the less fun part of this, though, is that when we start to look at this and its impact on the broader economy and the fact that WeWork is still around and this guy has all this money and all those people are still laid off, it does not feel like a story of accountability.
That's exactly what I think a lot of people have said after reading our book. They're like, you want the ending to be so different. And I mean, reading all these stories and everything, like it is capitalism. There is a sense should work differently than this. There should have been these guardrails. Like, why weren't there these guardrails on Adam Neumann during the buildup of this company? I mean, could he have been this visionary, but had guardrails around him that didn't let him do the things that were as crazy that he was very tempted to do? And then, why was there only a comeuppance for the people who work there, but not for the founder who built the company, but did a lot of things to take it down.
Or any of the investors
Exactly.
Maureen Farrell, she's a correspondent at the Wall Street Journal, also the author of a new book coming out about WeWork and Adam Neumann. It's called The Cult of WeWork, Adam Neumann, and the Great Startup Delusion. And I think that last ender bit right there, that was the delusion, right? That people just want to believe, and so they do. And, oh, look what happens, right? Maureen, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Maureen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Crazy.
Great to talk to you both. Thank you so much.
See ya. And still it persists. It keeps on going.
Just for fun, I pulled up one of the decks, actually. Business Insider had got, I think it's hands on one of the presentations that Goldman Sachs had used to determine that this could be a $1 trillion company. And it does make you realize that, like, the power to just be a cult leader... Mm-hmm. is apparently enough. And I don't know why I'm wasting my time working so hard on things, because evidently you can include as a key business highlight, let's see, purpose-built technology powering entire platform.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's do that.
Key business highlight, win-win-win-win value proposition across constituents. That's not a business thing. Key financial highlights, massive global TAM, less than 1% penetrated.
Oh, we're doing it wrong. We're doing it right.
Rapidly improving efficiencies and economies of scale. This is this crap right here with also, by the way, a bunch of like pictures of like people talking about love and stuff and then living a true life. That was enough to get a bunch of bankers to be like, yeah, $1 trillion. I see it. What?
Okay. We're going to leave it there.
Yep. We're doing it all wrong.
Ponder our futures. We're headed to a break. Send us your comments on today's show or any show that we hear that we do. You can do it by sending us an email or a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Or you could call us, leave us a voice message if you want to do that. Our new phone number is 508-827-6278, 508-82-SMART. We're coming back.
Thanks,
anytime,
Kai.
Boss.
I was slacking. Literally. We'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
I Was Slacking. That's my new podcast.
I Was Slacking. I know, right?
Yeah.
I Was Slacking. It's actually kind of perfect. All right. I'm back. I'm focused. It's time for the news fix. Let's do this.
Let's do this.
I'm just reeling.
Yeah.
Reeling.
Yeah. It's an amazing story. And still, that company's worth, by the way, $9 billion. It's going to be a real estate company from now on. It's not going to be a tech company. Yeah. But holy cow.
Holy started cow. Out fun and it ended yeah. kind of sad.
Okay.
So let's talk about the news.
Yeah, I got a quickie, and it's a follow-up, actually, on the thing that I think you were out in Kimberly and I talked about, Naomi Osaka and the mental health challenges she had. And I want to talk about Simone Biles for a second, right? Was it you? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I want to talk about Simone Biles, who, spoiler alert, I'll give you 3 seconds to turn off the podcast. 1, 2, 3. She pulled herself out of competition at the Olympics because of mental stress. She basically said, mm-hmm. I wasn't there and I couldn't do it anymore. And number one, the courage that takes in the moment on the biggest stage for her sport on the planet to do that, I think is kind of amazing. But also mm-hmm. just the idea that we're putting all this stress on people is just, we gotta rethink that. And I just wanted to point that out as a follow-up to the conversation we had about Naomi Osaka. Number two, masks are coming back. The CDC reports the Financial Times and many others is set to require recommend. I guess they're going to recommend, right? It's guidance that the CDC gives masks for vaccinated people as Delta rises. And look, we talked about it yesterday and how, or maybe the other day about. No, it was yesterday. Sorry. I'm just all boogered up. About this is a pandemic now of the unvaccinated, but what happens when you get a pandemic of the unvaccinated is that the rest of us are put more at risk. And so we got to wear masks. And number one, put your mask on, but number two, get your shots. And please try to convince those of you in your orbit who haven't gotten their shots to do that, even though it's really hard to convince them. That's what I got.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just as a side note related to that, yesterday, I said, we are going to have to create space for people to have a change of heart, take responsibility for that change of heart, and then convince others in their orbit, right? Yep. It doesn't mean that we cannot hold people accountable and responsible for their actions when they decide not to get a vaccine and then put everyone around them at risk. Mm-hmm. And I will say that it is hard to do that, though, when you then see someone try to make that change and that about face in the Washington Post, for example, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey, and also just take a swipe at anti-masking at the same time.
Yep.
Like, you cannot deliver your spoonful of sugar with another spoonful of misinformation. Not helpful.
Yeah.
But it's something.
Yep.
So I'm trying to stick with my advice yesterday. But one thing that people have cited, and we were actually talking about this before the show in Slack, oh, right, we have a show. We could totally talk about this there. Is that one thing some vaccine holdouts have cited is this thing about how the FDA, these vaccines are currently being used under an emergency use authorization. They are not technically fully approved by the FDA, despite being in the bodies of tens of millions of people, hundreds of millions around the world, I would assume. And so there is starting to be this question about, like, hey guys, what's taking so long? And as of actually just today, a World Health official, Biden predicted that the FDA would give final approval to the FDA to these vaccines by mm-hmm. the fall. But he kind of said, like, sometime maybe in the beginning of the school year, at the end of August, beginning of September, October, they'll get a final approval. And there are plenty of health officials out here who are saying, like, this really maybe shouldn't take so long. Yeah. And listen, I don't know what takes so long. Full disclosure, I do not know what kind of data gathering they do and scientific verification is happening as on the road to this final approval. However, I find it not totally credible that they would not approve the vaccines, right? Now that they're in so many bodies. So maybe, like, get it done and help everybody out.
As you pointed out in Slack this morning, I guess, they approved that janky Alzheimer's drug like this, right?
Right.
And you're like, come on, man.
like, come on.
Right.
There's no, if you want there to be trust in institutions, one, I would like to see some transparency about what exactly the FDA is doing that takes this amount of time. Yeah. That would be great, right? Because then we would know. I mean, you literally have, like, the dean of Brown University School of Public Health on Good Morning America saying, a lot of us are baffled why the FDA is taking so long. But on the other hand, you have this kind of, like, sketchy situation with the Alzheimer's drug treatment. And we got to tighten up. Yeah. I know there's a lot going on right now and everybody's tired, but, like, tighten up.
You know what's funny? Sorry. You just saying that. Yep. There's a lot going on and everybody's tired. We were saying that, like, last June, July, August, right? You know?
Yeah.
And I think we're going back to that place where there's a lot going on and everybody's tired. We had a brief moment of, and now we're all tired again.
Wow. You know, I was actually thinking that about Simone Biles.
Yeah.
There's that sort of hue, and all of these athletes who have said, like, my mental health is suffering. Mm-hmm. Of course it is.
Yeah.
Whose wouldn't be? And it's not just about, like, yes, it's absurd. Like, she's in the middle of this, like, really controversial Olympics, and some people are mad that it's even happening, which I have vacillated on myself, despite it being such good TV. She's, like, the one in all the commercials and the TV and the everything. One. But then on top of that, we're in the middle of a pandemic still. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all of this stuff. Everything is so much harder. There's still this, like, pandemic tax on life where everything is just hard. And so everything you're doing has an added burden still.
Yep. Totally.
Yep.
Okay.
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 So that's it for our Buzzkill news picks. Let's
it's not like we try, man.
We're back, babies. We're back.
Yep.
Let's do the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
So recently, I love this, I have been trying to say global warming instead of climate change because of the history behind the phrase climate change, which is that it was essentially, you know, marketed to people as a political effort to downplay global warming. Here is a listener with a different and pretty good idea.
Hi, this is Paula from Johnstown, New York. I would like the media to consider changing their use of the term climate warming to climate crisis, because it seems like we are in one.
Yeah, I'm on board with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
And our producers note, and this is true, that instead of climate change, The Guardian has been using climate emergency, climate crisis, or climate breakdown. And then over global warming, they've been saying global heating, which I think is just kind of British. Yeah. But it's true that since I've been trying to say global warming, it does sound sort of outdated and itself kind of non-specific, so maybe climate crisis is the way to go, or climate emergency. Yeah, I like it. Good note, Paula. Thank you.
When Kimberly was on last week, she talked about polyamorous relationships. We had a whole conversation about her dating app usage. This is apparently also known as ethical non-monogamy. And we asked y'all to tell us what you think of it, and a lot of you wrote in. Here is a voicemail we got from Kai, no relation, spelled differently, by the way, in Kansas.
Somebody who's been doing polyamory in a relationship that I've had for a long time, I'm just happy to hear y'all name it on the show. I think you're absolutely right, Kimberly, in naming that there are wide swaths of the population that go unnoticed, not only by media representation, but also by a lot of marketing agents. And lots of times I'm like, you know what? You could probably have more of my money if you made it appealing to me and spoke to people like me.
Yeah.
Nice. <You know. laughs> Yep, definitely. There was some commentary recently, actually, on how targeted advertising, I think it was related to the outing of a priest. I was sort of traveling, by quickly. But there was a lot of commentary on the fact that it's because marketing companies are trying to make as much money as they possibly can on the LGBT community. And it's led to these types of targeted ads that caused that to happen.
Here's one more on that same discussion, and it's based on an observation I made about this podcast and what gets said on it and presented on it is kind of different than the way we would say it on the actual air, where sensibilities I perceived were different. Anyway, here you go.
Hi there. As somebody who listens both to the radio and the podcast, I do have a concern about polyamory. It's just wrong. It should be polyphilia or multi-amory. Who mixes Latin and Greek? All the love, consensually, of course, from Robin in Portland.
Ah, public radio.
I love our audience so much.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, man.
Also, I just love that you guys talked about this because, man, is it a thing.
Yeah, and unbeknownst to moi, let me just tell you. Okay. Yep. We are going to leave you now with the answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, you later found out you were wrong about? And we're going to do it with Sally Krawcheck, who used to be the chief financial officer at Bank of America back in the day, left that for a lot of reasons, but started a female-focused investment firm called Elevest. I talked to her this past week in New York. If it's loud, it's because we were sitting on a sidewalk on the Upper West Side. Anyway, here you go.
The fundamental fairness of business, that if you work hard and you deliver the results, that's what you need in order to move ahead. And in my career, that's been the case most of the time. But there have been times when it just hits you flat in the face.
So that was Sally Krawcheck. She's at Elevest right now in New York. The interview airs today on Marketplace. I think it goes like 5.5 minutes, something like that. So you get a little bit of what she is trying to do, especially coming out of this recession, by the way, and women, and not just the pay gap, but the wealth gap and the investment gap. Pretty interesting interview. Anyway, I think. Of course, I think.
I love this.
Yeah.
I'm looking at Elevest right now.
She's really good.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
But yes, finding out that you were wrong about the fundamental fairness of business is...
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tough part of growing up, everybody. Before we go, I'm going to make a quick plug. If you've put off emailing or sending us a voice memo with your answer to the Make Me Smart question, we have made it much easier. You can just call us and leave a voicemail with our new number, 508-82-SMART, 82-SMART. 508-82-SMART. Just call us. Tell us what you were wrong about. It's okay. We're not going to judge. We appreciate it.
I wonder if we're due for a revision on yours and my answer to that, by the way. I'm not sure my answer has changed, but we might want
to. A lot has happened.
Yeah.
We got to find them. Where were they, I wonder?
Oh, I don't know. Somebody will know.
That's a good idea. Now we're going to have to do it. Thanks for nothing.
Liana, get us out of here. Before I get us into more trouble.
Help.
Here's more work. Do this. Think about this. Make Me Smart, which is this podcast that you've just spent the last half an hour listening to, is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters, also our smart speaker skills. Grace Rubin is our intern.
Today's program was engineered by Liana Squillaci with mixing by Emma Erdbrink. Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed this rockin' song you're listening to right now. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner, and the executive director of On Demand is Satara Nyibas.
Did I tell you I saw Ben the other day? He came in to have lunch with Jeff Peters. Looks great.
Yeah,
life is good. Life is good.
Good.
Yeah, he's doing well.
Ben, I mean, really, I know we go on and on about both Ben and Daniel, but it's because they're such good humans.
Good guys. Yeah, for sure.
Such good humans.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.